I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Iowa State Fair is the unofficial beginning of the election cycle. It saw candidates taking turns addressing fairgoers, and it had journalists from both coasts following the candidates. In those reporters' attempts at conveying life in the Midwest, something noted by journalists who live and work here is that their coastal brethren are getting it wrong. Today, a panel of Heartland reporters offer its best advice to set things straight. Then, are you thinking about different living arrangements in retirement? Maybe you want to scale down or up. Our smart money experts will explore the options out there now and give us an idea of what we should consider when it comes to where we spend our retirement years. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Getting a bead on the heartland. That's what many national reporters are doing these days as they race to cover the Democratic presidential race, which has a big focus these days on Iowa, the state that hosts the first major political test each cycle with its famed Iowa caucuses. Too bad so many reporters never quite get the heartland. They call us flyover country. They think we're all farmers. They think we all eat breakfast at diners where the views of locals tend to open up to too many political stories. KCUR's political KCUR's Peggy Lowe, you're not a political reporter,
nope,
has outlined all this in a piece she put out the other day on her website, peggylowe.org. Her conclusion, too many reporters fall back on the same old tired cliches to describe life out here in the middle part of the country, far from the coast. With us is the muckraking Peggy Lowe, who, besides reporting for KCUR, reports for Marketplace and Harvest Public Media. Peggy, good morning.
I love the muckraking
there
title.
There you go. Also with us is Chris Husted, who's a senior reporter at KBIA over in Columbia. Chris, you there?
Yep, I'm here. How's it going,
good
everyone?
Good morning, yeah. And Jackie Fortier covers healthcare in Oklahoma for KGOU and Norman. Jackie, good morning to you.
I also cover healthcare for all of Oklahoma. Good morning.
Good deal. We're wondering if our listeners also notice this trend of national reporters getting the Midwest wrong. If you do, give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Peggy, you feeling better having gotten all this off your chest?
Good morning. Yeah. Yes, I do. You know, it's something I'd really thought about for a long, long time. And I guess I was surprised when I put it out on Twitter and on Facebook that I really hit a nerve. I mean, not just among my reporter friends, but just from the general public, you know, people who live in the Midwest and feel a bit, you know, maligned by the mainstream media.
I mean, what got you thinking about this problem with reporters not quite understanding the heartland?
It all goes back to the butter cow.
The butter cow.
I hate the butter cow. I'm sorry, butter, and I'm sorry, cows, but
that's a state fair thing, right?
Exactly. At the Iowa State Fair every year, there's this big, you know, cow, life-size cow made of butter. and every reporter I know, I mean, even NPR. NPR's done quite a few stories on the butter cow. So they do that story at the Iowa State Fair, sort of, you know, like a metaphor of mocking, I feel like, the Midwest. Mm-hmm. You know, here are all these just farmers eating all this butter. And I feel like talk to people and find out what's really going on. It's not just about butter cows.
And they use the butter cow. That becomes a stereotype for everybody who lives out here between the two coasts.
That's exactly right. And it's sort of just an easy way for reporters to parachute in from the East Coast and go, butter cows, I'm in the middle of the country, the heartland, which I hate that term too.
Ha! Chris Husted from KBIA in Columbia. Have you noticed a similar problem?
I have. It's interesting, especially I think post-2016, after that election, everyone started to try to want to figure out what's going on in the middle of the country. So you have journalists coming from both sides of the coast trying to tell the stories here or figure out who these people are. And there's tends to be a little bit of a you know, more of a curiosity of who we are here as opposed to covering us as an actual community of people who have different interests and nuances beyond just the state fair.
Jackie Fortier with KGOU in Norman. Is the issue here that all these reporters are just in a big darn hurry? They got to hit their deadlines. They got to, you know, write stories quickly. And they don't have time to invest in going out and talking to the real people that Peggy Lowe is suggesting they do?
I think that is probably part of the issue. I don't know. I've never worked for either area on the coast. I've been a reporter in Colorado and now in Oklahoma. But I mean, we do have this magical thing called the internet, right? Where you can maybe try to talk to people on Twitter. There's Facebook groups. I mean, that's what I do. I don't know a lot of these real small communities that I report on here in Oklahoma, but you can really make an effort. And I think that that's really kind of, you know, the thrust of Peggy's piece is that they should really make an effort and try to talk to people. I was in a really tiny town called Sealing, Oklahoma, for a piece that I did on teen pregnancy. And there's one restaurant in town, right? One. So there's your cliche with the diner.
Yeah.
But I went around and I talked to everybody there. And I made sure that I talked to you know, the teenagers who are working, you know, the families that were out having dinner, that you're not just going to the source that you think that you should get. And by that, I mean, you know, they're the demographics, particularly old white men. That's who we tend to hear from when we hear a diner story.
You know, this is a little painful for me because I'm a former diner reporter. I used to do some of that up in Iowa. That's where you go. You're on deadline. You don't have much time. You need a bunch of quick views, Peggy. And there's the good old diner where a lot of local folks are gathered.
You're absolutely right. And that was one of the things that drove the piece for me, in that I've been there too. I've parachuted in from Denver, from the Los Angeles area, and tried to do this. You're on the ground maybe 2 days. You know, you got to get back on the press bus, or your editor's, you know, clamoring for this story. So you're always looking for shorthand, you know, to
yes.
explain the Midwest, essentially.
Yes.
So our piece really, and I consider it our because everybody offered so much. Like Jackie, for instance, was the one that suggested, hey, don't just go interview the white guys in the diner.
Yes.
I mean, some of
that's the problem with the diners. I mean, I've, you know, plead guilty. That's absolutely a great point.
Because, for instance, one of the things that we suggested was go to a Mexican restaurant in town. And trust me, there are tons of Mexican restaurants in all these little towns, because essentially the workforce at the slaughterhouses are Hispanic in many areas. So go to the Mexican restaurant and interview folks about how they feel.
Yeah.
That's different.
Peggy, give us a sense, because the timing of your piece here is no coincidence. Presidential candidates are out in droves in Iowa, and the reporters are here from every major news outlet in the country, right?
They absolutely are. And so I feel like this is kind of our moment. You know, after the election of President Trump, a lot of the mainstream media did a lot of hand-wringing and said, we're going to put more people in the Midwest. We're going to cover the Trump voter. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I am not criticizing them for not doing that, because if I'm an editor sitting on the coast watching the fire hose of information coming off the Twitter from the president, you know, you've got to cover that, and you just have so many bodies. That's it.
Yeah.
So I'm not maligning them, but I'm just suggesting, now that you're here, hey, we've got some great ideas for you. So come talk to us and we'll help you out.
Well, this is happening, I think, at a time, Chris, when we all know there are fewer reporters on the ground. The deadlines are tougher than ever with social media and online reporting. I mean, this is it's difficult for the media. This is not easy stuff.
But correct. Yeah, there's a lot of newsrooms that can't or that don't have the resources to do as much coverage as they used to, even if we're talking national outlets. I think a way around that, and Peggy puts this in her piece, is that we need to utilize more of the local reporters and connect them to a national reporter outlet, because they already know the sources and the stories that they can help cover that story, that whatever it might be that the national outlet wants to cover but maybe doesn't have the resources to do it. A partnership there could work well.
Okay, I'm just saying, though, Chris Husted, you actually suggested that, so I'm calling you on that, honey.
Okay.
And I thought it was a really good suggestion, and Chris and I kind of worked on the wording of it so we didn't sound like sour grapes.
Right, we didn't want to be too defensive and say, no, you don't just not come, but just every time time you want to come, maybe use someone local to help
hire
you report
local.
That story.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, there was this story a few years ago, Peggy, that A.G. Sulzberger wrote for the New York Times when he was a Midwestern correspondent for the newspaper. I think today he's the publisher of the whole thing,
yeah.
So he's somebody. But in his piece, he talked about how difficult it was to find a vegetarian fare at restaurants when he first came to town. He got skewered for that by a lot of folks around Kansas City who said, hey, buddy, there are plenty of options out there. What did you make of that? Is that a prime example of what you're talking about here?
It is, but I'm gonna give him a kudos in addition to kind of wrapping his knuckles here because
well, you better, 'cause he's publisher of the New York Times.
Yeah,
he's gonna balance this out here. Yeah.
So I remember that piece because I had just gotten here in 2011. I had just moved here from Southern California, and he wrote a first person piece about how he's a vegetarian and how he's never lived in the Midwest and how hard it is to find good food here. So we decided we'd help him out at Harvest Public Media, and we created a map of the best vegetarian places, and the little map icon, we used iceberg lettuce because he had suggested the only vegetable available in most places was iceberg lettuce. That said, he also, though, wrote some of the first pieces, because he was stationed here.
Right.
He wrote some of the first pieces about, like, how, you know, the Mexican restaurants are everywhere. You know, go there. And he did some really great reporting, I thought, out of
the
Midwest.
That's great. Well, Jackie, let's go through some of the suggestions that to reporters that Peggy lays out in her piece about, again, how to cover the Midwest the right way. Number one, the entire Midwest isn't just Iowa. Tell me about that. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I live in Oklahoma, and it's definitely not Iowa. You know, there's very different problems. There's very different solutions. And I think remembering that is a really important point because, you know, there's a lot of policy differences between, you know, Iowa and Oklahoma are my go-to examples, you know, like Medicaid expansion and things like that. And that's something that a lot of times reporters from the coast will parachute in and ask about, but they aren't really thinking about what it's like on a day-to-day basis there. I mean, you know, the go-to question of like, well, do you still support Trump after blank?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's very, very problematic. And I mean, you really just need to learn to ask some better questions or think about it. I mean, people can get very defensive, especially if they think that they're being attacked from someone not from their area, asking these kind of probing questions about how you vote, which is, you know, a pretty personal issue.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, it just takes a little bit more time. I mean, you know, dog parks are a great place to go where people want to talk and you get a decent slice of the population.
That's interesting. And you get a more diverse slice of the population, perhaps, at a dog park because everybody's got a dog these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, Peggy, to Jackie's point, there's a lot of truth to this idea that each state has its own culture. Each state has its own ways of doing things. And there are big differences when you go from Iowa to Missouri to Arkansas and everywhere in between. Yeah,
that's absolutely right. I mean, we all have our own, you know, sort of ethnic makeup and racial makeup. And I think that we need to call out those subtleties in national reporting. I would also suggest that Chris and Jackie and I, we get this because we have this odd thing in public radio in that we live here, so we get it. We cover our local communities,
right.
But our stuff runs nationally. Mm-hmm. Like Jackie just did an incredible coverage of an opioid trial in Oklahoma that ran on national lines for days.
Hmm.
And thank you.
And it was great reporting, and it gave great perspective from a woman on the ground there. So I think that we're trying to be kind because we also have to do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. We have to be that national reporter.
Yeah. So, Chris, your point is that national reporters might look to local reporters more often to sort of give them the lay of the land and a feel for where they are.
Absolutely. It's funny. There's oftentimes we'll find out that there is a reporter from a national outlet running around in our backyard. And I get a little defensive about it, but especially when they just call you up and ask for your sources. That's a little challenging and not something that is the sources that we've developed, we've put together and worked on for years. So to see someone come in and just use our sources and then blow out of town is not the greatest relationship among outlets. So tapping into someone and partnering together, I think, is good. NPR does this, I think, fairly well. They're getting better at it as opposed to just sending someone in to the town of, right now it's Iowa. You'll hear, I mean, Sarah McCammon, we hear her all the time, but she has a relationship with the station there. She has a relationship with Iowa. Mm-hmm. That's a good person to have doing the national outlet who understands the communities.
And she once lived in Kansas City. She was a speaker mm-hmm. for Radioactive this mm-hmm. year when she came out here from Washington. Okay, Chris, another point here that Peggy makes, not everyone in the Midwest is a farmer.
Really? That's correct. Shocking, right?
Yes.
There's actually a series that Harvest Public Media did a couple years ago called The Rural Urban Divide. And we decided to go out and cover different communities that weren't farmers. People that were not farmers. So we went and talked to schools, churches, business owners, people who are maybe surrounded by agriculture and farmers, but don't participate in that business. And you learn a lot more things that you would trying to understand how the rural communities work in the Midwest versus what you think a lot of national outlet reporters think they're going to find when they come to the Midwest and talk to a farmer. There's a lot more issues, like Jackie had mentioned, than just agriculture, even though it's huge. And it's important and it affects a lot of people. There's a lot more things going on. So find those other people and talk to them, like the teachers.
You know, what is it about the uber focus on farmers? Is it just because farmers are people who just don't exist to any significant level on the coast, Peggy? Or what are we talking about here?
I do think
there's such a fascination with them.
Yeah, I think it's kind of exotic to people on the coast. Yes. Like I'm often on the phone with my editor on the West Coast when I file for Marketplace. And she's like, well, where did you get this tape? I'm like, well, I was in the combine with the farmer, you know? And she's like, oh my God, that's so great. How did you get that? You know? And I'm like, well, you make a call and you climb up there.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do. You know, it's almost like they treat this like foreign reporting. And that's the part I hate about it. You guys live here too. We're not just the big square states out in the middle. Don't use the F word, flyover country. Yeah. We don't like that. And so just come on out and talk to us and find out what's really going on.
That's such a slap, that term, flyover country.
It's a big slap. It yeah. means we're not really worth even driving across, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's awful.
Jackie, to Peggy's point number 7 in her piece, we're talking this morning about how national political reporters oftentimes get the Midwest wrong. Her point number 7, for the love of all that's whole milk, when you're at a city or a suburban coffee shop, don't assume you can't get soy or almond milk. So you can really get soy or almond milk out here in the Midwest.
It's amazing. We have grocery stores. We have like Amazon delivery. It's fantastic. But I mean, it kind of plays to a larger point, though, right? I mean, people think that like Native Americans, for example, we have a very large Native American population in Oklahoma, and everybody thinks of Native Americans as like living out on reservations. There's actually no reservations in Oklahoma, which has a very complicated explanation. But, you know, many people live in city centers, like we were talking about earlier, because that's where the jobs are. There's fewer people who are being farmers these days. So, I mean, yeah, just really treating reporting around here as not a foreign correspondent and thinking about, like, where you would go. Like, if you would go to a pot shop in your new hometown, go to a pot shop. There's right. a lot of them in the Midwest.
That's a great
idea. You
can
talk to, you know, totally different people than you're probably going to get at the diner. You know, people here have differing views on things. And you can kind of get that, you know, broad take from a lot of different people. Even in small towns, they may actually disagree with each other. And that's something that I also see in reporting, especially from the East Coast, like mm-hmm. they hold up one or two people and say, okay, well, this is what everybody in this town thinks. And
yeah
it's usually not true.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, basically that we're all in lockstep and we're not.
Yeah.
Not at all. And to Jackie's earlier point, most of us live in, you know, the cities and the suburban areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the population is concentrated. So report from there, people.
Yeah. You know, the guy I looked up to the most when I was a young reporter was a guy named David Broder of the Washington Post, longtime Pulitzer Prize winning political writer for the paper who passed away several years ago. But his whole thing was one of the points you make next here, Peggy, which is polls are misleading. Get out of the newsroom, go out in the country and actually, you know, talk to people. David Broder did that all the time. I did a lot of it too, but not nearly as much as I wanted to, because you're just always sitting on top of a crushing deadline.
Absolutely.
And you didn't have that luxury to go out, as we talked about earlier, and just talk to folks door to door. And boy, you learn a lot when you do that.
You absolutely do. And I think polling became like something new in journalism as we were coming up, Steve.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you gather data about what people are thinking. So we did start using polls, and we have overused them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things at the Atlantic—
We overuse them because we don't have time to get out and talk to people ourselves.
Absolutely, because we're filing every single day.
Yeah.
The Atlantic said that we must use polls as a starting place rather than a conclusion. And I think that that's very, very accurate. I liked that.
How much do you trust the polls right now, Jackie?
Well, I covered the GOP on election night in Denver, so I don't trust them a whole lot, because that night taught me a lot about trusting polls.
Because the Republicans, you thought, at least the polls said, were going to win, and they didn't win, right?
Very much so.
Yeah.
I had never covered a national election like that, and I was sent to go cover the GOP because everyone thought that Clinton would win. Our politics reporter went to the Democrats, and that night turned out very differently. So, and like Chris mentioned, I mean, that really had this renewed focus on the center of the country. And I kind of question how much that's actually played out a couple years later.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Don from Olathe. Don, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much. It's a very interesting discussion, and I won't use that flyover word.
thank you, John.
I describe it as kind of the third coast. And we've got the left coast and the right coast and the east and the west, but the coast that's here is full of opportunities for learning, and a lot of different cultures exist here. And so your reporters are right on in terms of trying to find just exactly what the outcomes might be that affect the folks in the Midwest when the policies are created, or, you know, litigations out in California or resolutions or something that affects one of those areas. Well, then what's the similarity or difference out here in our states? So thank you very much for your program.
Yeah, good.
Thanks,
comments,
Don.
I appreciate it. Ultimately, what kind of comments and reaction did you get to this piece, Peggy?
I was absolutely surprised that it resonated with so many people. Had tons of shares on Facebook. Twitter went insane, especially after my boss, CJ Genevieve, tweeted it out like, "Dear coastal reporters, listen to her," that
of
thing.
Really?
And that went crazy. So I just think that there's a lot of people who are offended by the coverage lately.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by the reaction you got?
Very surprised, because so many people agreed with me, which of course is gratifying.
Doesn't always happen, does it?
It rarely happens.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to wrap up this segment here. I want to thank our reporters for coming in today. Peggy Lowe, who reports for KCUR Marketplace and Harvest Public Media. Chris Husted, a senior reporter at KBIA over in Columbia. Jackie Fortier, who covers healthcare in Oklahoma for KGOU in Norman. Thank you all for good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Coming up, a conversation with our smart money experts about where you might think about living when you approach retirement age. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Today is Up-to-Date Newsletter Day, and you can get one, too. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Get exclusive insights from me and highlights from KCUR's Up-to-Date team right in your inbox each Monday. It's just easy to get by going to kcur.org/Kraske. So retirement is looming. Money will be a major consideration. And so is something else. Where do you live? There are lots of options these days. You could downsize. You could move into a senior living facility. You could go live near your kids, or you could simply stay right where you are. We're going to talk about these options now with our Smart Money team, and smart they are. Lucas Butchell is a Director of Investment Management for Aspire Wealth Partners. Lucas, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners. That's in Brookside East. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning.
Sandy Weaver is the founder of Weaver Financial, based in Mission. Sandy, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
And just a quick note that the information presented by our guests is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as a recommendation related to your personal situation. Please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decisions. Well, let's start, Lucas, with current event leads. The stock market is volatile. It's back, bouncing up and down. What's going on?
Well, we've got a variety of factors. The trade tensions would seem to crop up every few months. Got kind of intensified last week with Trump threatening additional tariffs on China and then kind of pulling back until after the Christmas season. So that's kind of got investors wondering what the way forward is. You've got the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates now, so they had a big pivot over the last year. Mm-hmm. And then just big picture, economic growth across the globe is slowing. And so anytime that happens, investors start to get concerned and kind of wonder about corporate earnings across the globe.
Barbara, how nervous are your clients?
They are nervous, but I have to say they've been nervous for a while because we haven't seen volatility in a long time. And one of the things I would add to what Lucas says is this volatility is normal. It's just that we haven't seen it in many, many years. Mm-hmm. And people think back to the last period of volatility and they're thinking 2008, and it makes them even more nervous.
Boy, that was a moment for all of us. Sandy, how about your clients? What are you hearing from them?
They're pretty steady. You know, we're diversified out, so we have some high risk, some low risk. Mm-hmm. So, long-term investors.
Do you recommend, Lucas, at a time like this, with, again, volatility being the key word, is it time for investors to rethink the market?
I would advise investors to review their portfolio and rebalance potentially if their portfolio is out of balance from their strategy. So the S&P 500, even with the most recent volatility, is up north of 16% just this year. So it's been a great year for stocks overall. And so if you're even a little overextended on stocks, now might be a good time to rebalance. But you shouldn't be selling in fear. It should be what's my long-term strategy and making sure you're in line with that moving forward.
Yeah. How do people rebalance, Barbara? What do you do to rebalance?
What we're encouraging clients to do is take their profit off the table and put their money into something more stable, perhaps bonds, perhaps cash. It kind of depends on what they need the money for and when they need it. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal call. But we agree with Lucas. If a lot of the portfolios we're looking at, they just have too much stocks because the stock market is up so high and probably higher than they're comfortable with. Yeah. So you just sell the profits and reinvest into something different.
So let's say you've just turned 60. How much of your portfolio should be in stocks, just roughly?
You know, I'm not even going to touch that question because that's why it's called personal financial planning.
Yeah.
It depends. The answer is absolutely it depends.
How many more years are you going to work, when you're going to retire, all that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
What about bonds flipping upside down, this inverted yield curve we've heard so much about, Sandy? What is that?
Yeah, that is when the short-term interest rate is higher than the long-term interest rate.
Which is just the opposite of what it's supposed to be.
Exactly.
Right?
That doesn't make sense. You know, you should be paid more for having a long bond. But the 90-day and the 2-year are higher than the 10-year. And even the 30-year dropped below 1.5% last. Or no, that dropped below 2% last week. But
and this is usually seen as a harbinger of a recession.
Almost
on the horizon,
every recession
right?
has had an inverted yield curve in front of it. But an inverted yield curve is not always succeeded by a recession. So there are false positives on that.
Yeah, when you start talking about inverted yield curves, Lucas, you know the world's turning upside down. I mean, that's just whatever that is, we got to worry about it now. Okay. Well, let's turn to our main topic this morning, which is living the retirement dream, housing options for your final years. And we'll cover various scenarios here and strategies for people wanting to age in place or downsize or reconnect to the city core. What's the issue here, Lucas? Just frame it for us a little bit.
Well, what you have is you have a lot of people that are retiring, and our population's getting older. And so there's more and more people considering where am I going to live when I'm retired, when I'm not working? And, the options, there's a lot of them, and people are getting more creative now in terms of where they're going to live and kind of how they're going to live. And so there's a variety of choices to consider, and it's lifestyle-based and kind of health-based. And so we've got a lot of things we can talk through and consider, help listeners think about.
Well, the world's turning upside down, Barbara. When my wife and I have had that conversation in the last year, and it's like, holy smokes. And the breakfast crowd I get together with on the weekends occasionally, that conversation now is about retirement and money. And And we never had those conversations before. Suddenly we're talking about this stuff, you know?
Well, and that means that you are part of the 47 million, what we're going to call seniors.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to guess your age, but we're calling seniors somebody. I'm going to tread carefully here.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about for seniors is somebody who's 65 years old, because we've got to draw the line somewhere.
I'm not there yet. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But there are 47 million of them. They're 14.5% of the population. But by 2060, that number is going to more than double. And that's why we're seeing so many new housing options coming to the market, because the baby boomers are going to need them and they're going to demand them.
Some of these housing options, Sandy, let's turn to some of those. One of them is to age in place. You hear that term a lot. What does that mean?
It means you do not want to go to a assisted living or a senior living facility or, you know, nursing home.
You want to stay in your house like my dad. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But and there's lots of things about updating the home, you know, putting shower bars in, that type of thing. The other thing, though, and I've worked with a client on this, you need to plan ahead if you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, to assume that everything will go perfect is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, when I've worked with one client I'm thinking about, you know, we had encouraged her to have someone come in the home just maybe one afternoon a week, two afternoons a week. Both of the adult children lived in Arizona, one in Montana. But the problem is, then, if you are unwilling to do even that, when the first crisis comes along, the healthcare crisis, you know, you end up in rehab, you can't go home because you don't have any infrastructure in place. You don't have anybody you've been working with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're going to age in place, then you need to do some good planning.
What kinds of home updates, Lucas, might you be looking at? Barbara just mentioned shower bars, which make a whole lot of sense. What else should people be thinking about there?
One of the big ones is wider doorways for things like walkers or wheelchairs, so you can get easily from one room to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, a bedroom on the main floor, so you don't have to go up and down a lot of stairs to, you know, get to bed, to the kitchen, to the living room. So if you've got a home that's really broken up, especially with the variety of floors, that may not be the best place as you age and maybe have more difficulty with steps. And another thing is, you know, replacing doorknobs or handles with levers, so they're easier to turn.
I never thought about that
As your motor skills on their hands get a little bit more difficult.
So remodel my house or look for one that already has these things. Is that what we're talking about, Barbara?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what aging in place pretty much. You can stay where it is or where you are, and I think that's really what aging in place is. You like where you are, you would prefer to stay there, and frankly, the social aspects of this are a huge driver to aging in place. We've heard a lot lately in the media about loneliness and how devastating it can be, especially for the older population.
Right.
And that's one of the real appeals about aging in place and staying where you are. You know your neighbors, you know your community, you know where the grocery store and the bank are. That's part of your social fabric. That's important to aging in place.
But typically what that means, Sandy, is then you've got to begin thinking about spending more money to have somebody else maintain your house, because you don't want to go up on the ladder anymore, which is something I've been debating myself of late. But that means spending more money out of pocket.
Right, yeah. And a lot of the options that we've listed today, you know, you will be spending, whether you go to a senior living facility or age in place. You do have to plan ahead for those things.
Yeah.
Getting old in our country can be expensive.
There's also this idea of transportation, and maybe you have to bite the bullet at some point and not be able to not drive your own car anymore, because that becomes problematic. What do people need to think about there, Lucas?
Well, especially if you're staying at home or aging in place, you know, in our community especially, there's not a lot of great public transportation in the suburbs or, you know, out of the city core. And so really thinking through what that would look like, and inevitably knowing, you know, that there are some busing options available and other things, but planning ahead for transportation is important. Some of the other retirement community type options tend to have a lot more available transportation to get you to the grocery store, the post office, the bank, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Barbara.
And I have some senior clients that are devoted to Lyft and Uber.
Yeah.
That has become very popular among that age group.
Pretty easy thing to do.
It is.
And you don't have to get the car
out of the driveway. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really a good point. Okay, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about senior living options when retirement begins to loom. And do you want to stay in your home? Should you think about moving out? If you have questions for our good panel here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888, where you can tweet tweet us at KCUR up to date. Okay, Sandy, many seniors find themselves in a large home, too much space. When the kids are launched and they're out of the house, there's often this urge to downsize to a smaller house that may fit their retirement lifestyle. But that involves a whole lot of thinking, too, a lot of issues there.
I think this is an exciting option because you, once you're empty nesting, you have a chance to say, what do I want the next third to look like?
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend who was a principal of one of the charter schools over in the Kansas City, Missouri district. At 67, she moved to independent senior living, and she locks the door and travels, just loves it. You know, she was a little bit young to move to a facility like that, but she has enjoyed it immensely.
Hmm.
You know,
it worked out for her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Why is it exciting, do you think? Just because it's the prospect of trying something new?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Lucas, any thoughts on what to do with all the stuff that you accumulate, which is, again, something that I've been spending a little bit of time with lately. Stuff in my house.
Yeah. This is
books, and I got a lot of books.
This is a really common one that we hear from clients is, you know, hey, I'd like to downsize. I'd like to move somewhere else, but I've got this house full of stuff, and I don't know what to do with it. I don't feel comfortable throwing away, you know. My kids keep telling me they don't want it, so they end up with a basement or an attic full of things that they, to move, they know they're going to have to deal with and go through that emotional process of sorting through, you know, maybe family heirlooms or pictures or things that they want to keep, but don't, or they're not probably not going to have space for in their new home,
yeah.
And they can't find anywhere else to pawn it off to like their kids.
That sounds like not a big deal, but it's a really big deal. It's a whole set of tough decisions. And once you've been a talk show host for 17 years, you realize how many books you accumulate during that time. So I have an excuse that other people don't have. But it's still, I want to read a lot of those books someday.
Well, and you should, but mm-hmm. Do you really need, I think you need to go through and say, will I ever read this again?
I know.
And,
I know.
You know, and a Kindle holds a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
So is it necessary for you to physically possess them? But this is one of the reasons, interestingly, why antiques have fallen out of popularity. That's something that I hear. I have these fabulous antiques and I'm going to give them to the kids. And you approach the kids and they say, I don't want that old stuff.
Yeah, right.
And so there's not much of a market, or not as much of a market as there used to be for fine antiques.
I'm told that market's down just from talking to people about it. People don't want the old stuff.
Well, and the other thing, too, is an auction place can help. But I think seniors are making a mistake if they think I'm going to have an auction, I'm going to make so much money and my financial success and retirement will be secured and I'll go on. It doesn't work that way. It may not be, you may not get the value that you perceive you have in your possessions.
Yeah, that's interesting because downsizing doesn't necessarily mean, it can mean, but not necessarily mean you're putting a whole bunch of money in your pocket, Sandy.
Yes, and I'm going to, you know, dish on this parade a little bit. If your retirement projection has been assuming that you will pull, say, 50 grand or 100 grand out when you downsize, and your retirement projection is dependent upon that, then you need to, you know, be modest in your expectations of what the next step is, because you're probably not at a phase in life that you can make up a shortfall. You see what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Right.
So if you've said, you know, we're going to sell the farm and move to town, and we're just going to buy something really small in town, that needs to happen then. Either that, or you're willing to pare down the spending for each and every year through the rest of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not all fun and games. This is a numbers shifting too.
And these days, buying the next home, it can be a lot more expensive than it's going to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because the market for those houses in the $300,000 range in Kansas City, I'm told, is through the roof. You can't get them.
That's
you know,
true.
If you're coming down from $500,000 or $700,000 house.
Yeah.
So all kinds of problems here, Lucas.
Yeah, I think the just reasonable expectations. And the other thing that, you know, folks, as they get older and make more money, they tend to have finer tastes, right? And so when you're looking to change homes, you know, what was okay when you bought the house you're in may not be what you prefer to have now. And so just knowing that again, expectations of downsizing probably not always meaning down costing, and just being okay with that, or setting your expectations maybe lower than maybe what they are now is reasonable.
So the rule of thumb for folks listening to this who are trying to navigate, Lucas, would be, what? I mean, go into this with your eyes wide open, do a little homework, be open to the changing world out there. Things may not be what you think they are necessarily.
Exactly. I think that's it. You're right on the button there, and just doing some homework. And if you're trying to figure out really what you want, and then how can you make that work into your retirement plan, to Sandy's point.
Yeah, Sandy.
I have one example. This is a decade old. My mother had a friend who had bought a condo and then bought some great furnishings. And my mom had talked to me then if I could solve this problem for her friend, and I declined. But you know, there was like $300,000 left in the investment portfolio, and this woman was in her 70s. Mm. You know, that is unworkable at the standard of living that the woman had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you cannot eat a sofa. You can't pay a medical bill with it. So really, the decision needs to be made while you're doing some number crunching on the alternatives. You know, a lot of these places around here, the buy-in for year one ranges from $135,000 to $350,000.
And then the buy-in for what?
If a continuum of care facility, mm-hmm. where you have your own villa, and then you just move on, you know, as to additional care. But
say those numbers again: $150,000 to $350,000.
$135,000 to $350,000.
Wow!
And the annual premium though to Kenyan is $32,064. So, you see what I mean? You know, those are like a John Knox or a Lakeview or those kind of places.
But so you got to fork out $30,000 to $40,000 to $50,000 every year to stay there.
Yeah, and then there's the first year buy-in part. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just saying you these are financial decisions as well as fund decisions.
Boy.
You know, and what you want for yourself.
That kind of sticker shock is going to be surprising to people, Lucas. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it really is. And really understanding the options. So those continuum of care options, which we've kind of moved to talk about, those are definitely becoming more popular. And so the way that works is, you know, you can get an independent living home potentially when you first start. And then as your health changes or you need more services, you can step up to assisted living or where you have people coming in to help, or even skilled nursing if you really need a lot of care. And you don't have to move a location. You may just have to change from one building to another.
Barbara, Jerry has emailed us this to ask, what options exist for those with limited resources? Most of the talk here assumes a good deal of money, and that isn't the situation for so many people.
A couple come to mind. One is what we've talked about, the age in place.
Mm-hmm.
Just be very cautious. Realize that even though you're in the house that you've been in for a long time, perhaps you need to restrict, maybe not use the second floor. I've had elderly clients that had lovely townhomes and they only saw the first floor. They'd send the cleaning woman up to the second floor only when the grandkids were coming.
Huh.
And that worked for them. So, Jerry, I would say think about staying where you are. And another one is the possibility of living with children, which is very cost effective.
And also very tricky.
It is a tricky. It's a slippery slope, but I've seen it work very, very well. And in some cases, if there still are young children in the house, you have caregiving provided both to the elderly parent and to the children. It's just another adult there. So if mom and dad are running late for dinner because they're working late, grandma can make dinner for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids make sure that grandma's taking all of her meds. So
right.
there's some real synergy in that relationship.
If you're going to do that, I'm just wondering, Sandy, what should you think about if you were thinking about living with your kids? What might you want to work through in your head before you make that decision?
Obviously, you want to have some ground rules about living. I've worked with a client in Texas who actually paid to have an addition put on her daughter and son-in-law's home. And there were grandkids, so they were doing what Barbara just went through. It was caretaking both ways for the younger generation and the older. The daughter and the son-in-law had pretty stable jobs down there. But the thing I was concerned about was there are now, if a lawsuit happens, someone comes on the property and there's a suit, there are more reachable assets. My client's investment portfolio is in that mix now.
Mm.
So, you know, we wanted, you know, a bigger umbrella liability policy, which would be carried by the daughter and the son-in-law. And that's not expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking to their insurance agent down there. The other thing, though, is if you pay to have an addition put on one of your children's homes, what happens if they die in a car accident?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want the beneficiary in that house to look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want it to go to the kids? Do you want a life estate to you? Or, you know, it's not just a quick one and done anymore. The other thing is, should you have life insurance on the daughter and the son-in-law? Again, because in case they have an auto accident. What happens if, you know, they default on that mortgage and now, you know, you're big addition that you put on the home is gone, do you have enough to turn around and go into a continuum of care facility? Mm-hmm. Those are two huge outlays. So it's there are things to think through when you do it.
Let's go to some calls here. Susan from Shawnee. Susan, you're on Up to Date with the Smart Money Experts. Good morning.
Good morning. This is more of a comment, and I don't think I heard anyone reference it. And it's an option that's out there. Instead of buying into a more expensive place, you had mentioned a couple earlier, and instead of aging in place, one of the things that I investigated and have found with my parents and in-laws is our apartment communities that are over 55, and the one in particular that I'm familiar with, they bought in at a lower price range, but then they kind of owned their own apartment. And the great thing I've thought about it is that the price point was less expensive than those continuing care facilities that you've mentioned. But also they had the increase in community by living with people that are the same age, and they're all looking out for each other and making sure everyone's taken care of. So that's more of a comment than anything. And if you're familiar with some of those, I'd appreciate comments on that.
Susan, if an older folk, a person who's thinking about different options, is interested in what you just said, where would they find it? What's the term they would look up on Google to run this down?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. The one that I'm referring to, I didn't want to mention the brand, but I will. There's one in Shawnee and Lenexa, and I think they've opened one in Lawrence, is called the Village Cooperative. And I think it's more mainly like senior, you know, over 55 living. Is the one that I'm familiar with.
Yeah. Senior Living Cooperatives really is what they're called, I think, is my producer is talking in my ear here. So, yeah.
Yeah, and what I like about it, again, is that they're with people their age, and so they don't have that isolation, and everyone's kind of looking out for each other, and there's lots of activities for them.
Barbara, any thoughts about Senior Living Cooperatives?
I have. There's a company that came in about, I believe it's 5 years ago, and started building these, and I think it's the ones that Susan is referencing. I know of two people who have gone into them. They absolutely love them. The nice thing about them is they have equity in the place. So if they die, the kids still get an inheritance. That was important to one of these people.
That's interesting.
The other was really triggered by the need to, they needed care eventually, not just yet. And if you go into these places at the beginning, you can design your own space. So as Lucas mentioned, sometimes these people have very nice taste.
Mm-hmm.
You get to choose the paint color and the basics.
You know, Deborah wrote us this. We opted to move while we were young enough to establish relationships. They're in their mid-50s and moved to the River Market. She did things like passing items to our kids while they were still young enough to need them. Ranch-style living. Everything's on one floor and accessible. Library, arts, restaurants, all accessible by walking. Just need the car for a trip out to the suburbs. And multi-generational experiences are great, she says. Our kids think we're hip. Not bad. I want to thank our Smart Money team here. Lucas Butchell, Director of Investment Management for Aspire Wealth Partners. Barbara McMahon, President of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside East. Sandy Weaver, Founder of Weaver Financial over in Mission. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Enjoyed it.
Tuesday on the show, before Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali, this cyclist was carving the way for black athletes. We'll look at the world champion who dominated a predominantly white pastime. Friday on the show, Jason and wife Diana Kander spoke candidly about the effects of PTSD on their family and professional careers. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.